This is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana. Thanks for joining me. You will love, well, at least I hope you will, the interview with my next guest, Ali Aliabadi, who is of Iranian origin. He has a science background and is obsessed with classical music. We're going to discuss his short book called On Martial Arts, Zen, and the Blue-Eyed, Red-Bearded Barbarian. Was the founder of Shaolin Kung Fu Chinese? Was Zen Buddhism created by a Japanese sage? Did you know that original descriptions and writings from China and elsewhere describe Buddha with European and even Nordic features? Did you know Caucasians roamed the Tarim Basin 1,000 years before East Asians? We'll discuss this and much more, so get comfortable because you're about to hear of an Indo-European descended wanderer into the Far East named Bodhidharma, the red-bearded barbarian, a venerated man in the Orient. Ali, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what is your heritage and how did you come to write a book about Nordic influence on Far Eastern civilizations and cultures?
Oh, that's a very pertinent and very eventful question. Thank you for asking that. I am of Iranian heritage. I've been in the United States since the age of eight, since 1984. And in Iran, I was fascinated and actually obsessed by everything American, which at that time, for me and for many other Iranians, Native America meant blonde-haired, blue-eyed America. So we were fascinated by Europeans of fair complexion. And in Iran, we still have a minority of fair complexion Iranians.
That's
some
right.
of whom are, yes, some of whom are my relatives. And I've always been fascinated by them and everything American. From there, as I came to the United States, when I emigrated, I essentially went through a phase of America worship, and as the book says that you read, a fascination with blonde-haired, blue-eyed Americans, which then burgeoned and segued into an interest in their culture, Western culture and Western civilization, which I always had a profound respect for from a child's viewpoint. But as I matured, I became a teenager's viewpoint and then finally an adult's viewpoint, and it's still growing, I think. And from there, I was then interested in classical music very much. I might toot my own horn and say that I have about 10,000 classical CDs devoted to Western music. So yes, it's a deep, deep passion and love for me. And from there, I was fascinated by a lot of literature. I'm a bookworm myself, so I picked up everything I could by Robert E. Howard, the author of Conan the Barbarian. I was reading stories of H. Rider Haggard, the British Victorian romance adventure historical author who wrote Alan Quatermain, She, and the Mines of King Solomon's Mines, excuse me. So they all dealt with, including Robert E. Howard, they dealt with civilizations that were in the most awkward of places. For example, deep, dark Africa, where you have a white queen ruling over savages. And you also had instances where Conan goes to the jungles and he finds ruins and he finds the leadership who are essentially mixed or some sort of mulatto-esque creation or result of an ancient, higher, more advanced people. So this kind of stuff was the stuff of science fiction, but essentially, and fantasy, but essentially I later found out that as I segued into nonfiction, specifically the works of Thor Heyerdahl, I noticed that this was a theme that many of these adventurers and these great imaginative fiction authors had purloined from nonfiction authors, archaeologists, and whatnot. So Thor Heyerdahl afterwards was a big influence on me, and his books such as Aku Aku and good Lord, I can't remember the other names of his, Fatu Hiva was one of his other works, and his magnum opus in which he discovered as he went on a balsam raft, he went to South America to Easter Island, and he kept making references of these creator gods and myths of a fair complexion man or men who came from the land of the rising sun, that is the East, and brought civilization and culture, animal husbandry, astronomy, religion, literature, writing, philosophy, essentially everything related to a culture and civilization, they brought to the New World, to the indigenous Amerindian people. And then later on in my other works, I essentially became fascinated by other tales. For example, Sir Oral Stein, who talked about the Tokarian or Sogdian settlements and Buddhist frescoes in Taklamakan Desert, and how the Buddhist monks were proselytizing to the Far East, to Great China. And so all of these essentially brewed in my mind's eye and finally came to fruition with that little ditty that I wrote and which you read. And it's been many years of a building upon what turned out to be a childish interest in things American, as silly as Hollywood movies, to things I think that are much less flippant, namely ancient meanderings and travails of Nordic people that have shown evidence from Polynesia to South America to even the southwestern United States, where the swastika is found, to ancient Chinese stories of blonde-haired emperors in the 4th century, Emperor Ming, all the way to the Eurasian plateaus, the steppes of Russia, of Siberian Russia, and of course to the Middle East as well. So I think that basically speaking, Nordics are the most intrepid race there is, and their heritage has been found throughout the globe. And I know you've had several other intrepid mavericks there, such as Mr. Nugent, that have spoken about the Solutrean people and all these little very politically inconvenient facts coming out about some bog in Florida showing Caucasian genotype or phenotypes, and the designs being Celtic, not Amerindian, and all of this information about Indian myths, for example, the red-haired giants of Nevada, which the Paiutes apparently exterminated tens of centuries ago, however long ago. All of these, I think, go together to build a picture that the world had some sort of Nordic influence throughout. And that's what I try to claim, a specific part, actually. I try to make a thesis of dealing with the founder of meditation or Zen Buddhism, who was also mythologically, perhaps even historically, the founder of Shaolin Kung Fu, as well as a great figure in Far Eastern Buddhism.
That's right. You present evidence that the founder of Buddhism, martial arts, and the Zen philosophy was an Indo-European descended wanderer into the Far East. So tell us about the man named Bodhidharma. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, Bodhidharma. Yes. Bodhidharma means enlightenment law, and it comes from the Sanskrit. And he apparently was, if memory serves me properly, a 6th century prince who the Buddhist hagiographers claim was the 28th descendant of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha himself. And if you recall from the work, one of the traits of being an enlightened being is to have blue eyes, which one might think, what does that have to do with Buddhism, since most of the people who practice Buddhism are of Mongoloid descent? They are of Far Eastern Asiatic descent. Well, that again traces the Scythian, if you will, Nordic heritage of Buddhism to its rightful place. If you go still to places like Kashmir and northern India and Nepal, you still find green-eyed, perhaps they're Mongol-eyed, but they do have green eyes, blue eyes, reddish copper hair, etc. You do find Nordic traits still, even though it's a minority and it's very attenuated, you still have their presence. Now, Bodhidharma apparently had, again, one of these epiphanies. And he had wanted to devote his life to proselytizing the one true path, in his opinion, Buddhism. And it's interestingly enough, some of the myths claim that he came from southern India, and he belonged to the Pallava dynasty. And there's an Indian gentleman, a researcher that I reference in the work, that claims that Pallava is very similar to the Middle Persian Pahlavi, which is where the late Shah dynasty of kings, whose last name was Han, meaning lord from the Mongol, but later they took the Middle Persian name Pahlavi, and before the 1979 Islamic Revolution. So there might be some sort of linguistic heritage there. And in southern India, there is Kalari Payattu, which is an ancient martial art which utilizes weaponry, and it's used in southern India. Now, with due respect to Dravidians and other non-essentially European, non-Nordic people, I am always from Missouri, the Show Me State. I question whether the Dravidians themselves came up with Kalari Payattu, the native art. I think given the research in the book and given the anecdotal as well as quite non-anecdotal research that we have found globally pertaining to Nordics, it seems more likely than not that this was some sort of Indo-European created fighting art, which was then later taken over by the mixed descendants or indigenous, if you will, servile class of the Nordic leadership, the Brahmins and the Kshatriyas, and later on utilized for its own purposes, considered an indigenous art, which I don't think it was. But anyhow, then this gentleman, Bodhidharma, went to the Far East, and in much of Asiatic painting, you'll be surprised, because as a very famous person once said, if you have eyes to see and ears to hear, things shall be open unto you. So I use that kind of attitude, and I noticed that a lot of Far Eastern artwork had Bodhidharma, especially Japanese Zen paintings, had this bushy-bearded, bushy-eyebrowed, large, non-Asiatic eyed barbarian who's actually balding, very Indo-European trait, comically enough. And his presence was very anomalous for me. But I later realized that actually it's anomalous to me because I was ignorant of Far Eastern art and Far Eastern history and philosophy. So that even the Chinese in their annals, as well as the Koreans, the Vietnamese, and the Japanese, make claim that this man was an Indian. And he was, but not an Indian in the sense of the modern mixed descendant of the original Nordic invaders to the Deccan Plateau, but rather of a more likely than not Nordic physiognomy, genotype, and phenotype. So that many of the annals of the Far Eastern peoples refer to Buddhist preachers and Buddhist proselytizers as blue-eyed barbarians, red-mustached barbarians, red-bearded barbarians, and we have seen the Tokharian mummies that the Chinese government, for nationalist reasons, is trying to subdue and obfuscate, and essentially, the Taklamakan Desert also houses the Buddhist frescoes that Sir Oral Stein in the late 19th, early 20th centuries discovered or rediscovered. And they show Nordic physiognomy, Sogdian and Tokharian merchants and monks next to Mongoloid versions, Chinese versions of Bodhisattvas, enlightened Buddhists and whatnot. So the heritage is there. And like much of the world, Nordics have had an unprecedented and inordinate amount of input into these cultures and civilizations. So we see in paintings that Bodhidharma himself, the so-called red, the devilish barbarian, the red-bearded, blue-eyed barbarian, as he was called in various Korean, Chinese, and Japanese sources, he performed some miracles. A very popular Chinese and Japanese painting is showing him with both feet on a reed crossing a river in China to go from one area to another. He apparently met a Chinese emperor, had a very portentous dialogue with him where the Chinese emperor said, I have built all these monasteries. I have translated sutras from Pali, a Sanskrit derivative, to Mandarin or whatever the ancient Chinese dialect was back then. What will I get? And Bodhidharma says, nothing. None of this means anything except your personal salvation, which you cannot win simply by giving goodies to various people. It must come from within. And after that, he retired, Bodhidharma, that is, retired to a mountain where even to this day, outside of the Shaolin Temple, you can see essentially a cave dedicated to him with a big statue in honor of Bodhidharma, which again has a bearded, bald-headed, very non-Chinese man.
Wow. I've never heard about this. This is incredible.
Yes. And if you can just check, you can type in Bodhidharma Cave, China, and you will see photos of this pilgrimage site for non-Chinese tourists as well. Now, the Shaolin Temple, Shaolin means new or young forest in Mandarin Chinese, and it was a temple built in honor of a Bodhisattva, I believe was the gentleman's name, another non-Chinese Indian or Central Asian Buddhist proselytizer who later had his position taken over by Bodhidharma himself. Now, legend says that Bodhidharma was the founder not only of Shaolin Kung Fu, again, that connection with southern India and Kalaripayattu, the native sport with weaponry that he apparently exported to China. Not only was he the founder of the Chinese martial art of Kung Fu, but he was also the founder of tea. So that when one day in prayer, he fell asleep and out of anger, he cut off his eyelids and tears poured out. And when they hit the ground, they sprouted tea bushes. And that is obviously apocryphal and spurious, of course. It's legend, but still I think it's kind of cute. And it's very interesting that that legend is attributed to him, so that the Shaolin monks there still have a statue of Bodhidharma on the temple grounds, and they practice very, really seemingly miraculous feats of physical prowess and acts of physical valor in their martial arts skills and displays for tourists, Chinese and non-Chinese alike. But all of that has come down from, as legend has it, Bodhidharma, the blue-eyed, red-bearded barbarian. Now, if you give me the freedom to go on a little bit more, I will say, thank you, I will say that his message was spread to Korea, where they call him not, because the Chinese have a very phonetic language, so Bodhidharma becomes Bodhidharmo, and in the shortened Chinese version becomes Dhammo. So in Korea, it became Dalma, given the language of the Koreans, and there is a mountain named in his honor as well. And in part of my work, I discuss the Sukhuram World Heritage Site in South Korea, which houses a big statue of the Buddha in, of course, in the meditative position. And around him are his apostles.
White disciples, right?
Yes, white disciples. And so Ananda, his second in charge, is not described as a Mongoloid, but as a Caucasian, as an Indo-European. Which is fascinating because I think it's Korean nationalist sensibilities that are miffed to think that their Buddha, that the founder of their religion, etc., was not Korean, not even Chinese, but looked like Ananda, was an Indo-European. But even though you have a false and jingoist interpretation of the statue of Bodhidharma in that Sukhuram World Heritage Site, the truth is that the Chinese, Korean, and Japanese chronicles and annals, as I cited, make specific reference to the blue eyes and fair complexion of Bodhidharma himself. So as this proselytizing monk, legend has it, left China, the Japanese believe that through Korea brought Buddhism to the Japanese islands, and the Japanese then took essentially Bodhidharma, whose name became Daruma, as their own. And Daruma has become a cross between old Saint Nick, the Easter Bunny, the founder of Bushido, the way of the warrior, the founder of the tea ceremony, the founder of the mastery of the samurai and Zen painting. So he is, according to one of the chroniclers that I reference in my work. Next to Mount Fuji, his paintings or paintings of him, of Bodhidharma, are the most common in Japanese painting culture. So I think that's very fascinating that most Europeans, including myself, I never knew that Daruma or Bodhidharma was had such a profound effect on these great culture civilizations, and specifically the Japanese, who view this man as more than just a preacher of meditation or Zen Buddhism, which, by the way, has its coevals in both, actually in China, Korea, and Vietnam. In Vietnam, one of the founders of Zen, or its version of Zen Buddhism, excuse me, came from India by the sea route, and he was a half Sogdian, half Vietnamese preacher. And Sogdians are depicted as Nordics. They are an Indo-Iranic people, who are depicted as Nordics in the Taklamakan desert, in the frescoes thereof, in the grotto that housed their paintings. So what you find throughout Southeastern Asia, as well as Eastern Asia, is Nordic blood. You find Nordic blood even in Mongoloid peoples. There's some claim by a German biographer of Genghis Khan that he came from a tribe called the Grey-Eyed Men, that Genghis Khan himself and his progeny had Nordic blood. You can still find pre-Russian-influenced Mongols who have fair complexions. You find stelae and various monoliths that no Mongol has ever created and no Russian colonist in the 18th or 19th century ever created. But you're talking about creations spanning well over a millennium ago. And essentially, to answer your question in short, Bodhidharma has had a profound influence on Far Eastern culture and civilization and everything that is attributed to them.
Oh, it's just fascinating. I'm really enjoying hearing this. But in your book, you cite many sources, including artwork like you've been discussing, that confirms that the propagators of Buddhism came from the Western regions, as the Chinese say. So let's talk about modern depictions of Buddha as a Mongoloid versus the more ancient sources. When did this switch happen that you know of?
Yes. Now, I am no expert in art history in any stretch of the imagination. As far as I know, the earliest depictions in painting of Bodhidharma are feature a Mongoloid Buddha, as well as they do feature a Mongoloid Buddha himself. However, there are some paintings as far as late as the 13th or 14th century that do depict the Buddha as non-Chinese. Now, Bodhidharma, on the other hand, except for maybe one or two paintings which are exceptional, have always been depicted as a non-Oriental man, as a balding, hairy, very heavy, bushy eyebrowed, beetling eyebrows, kind of angry guy who's, he looks a little constipated, actually, to be a little flippant. But he is always serious because the man is on a mission and he is seriously the leader of meditation, being the founder of meditative Buddhism or Zen Buddhism. But to answer your question, the Buddha has almost always been depicted as non-Indian, as non-Nordic. Sometimes, however, he is depicted as an Indo-European. That's the exceptional case. But Bodhidharma has almost always, with very few exceptions, been depicted as non-Chinese, as an Indo-European man.
You know, there was a well-preserved Viking ship called Osaberi found in a large burial mound in Norway, and the so-called Buddha bucket was also discovered, and it had brass and enamel ornamental bucket handles in the shape of Buddha in the lotus position with swastikas on them. And there was also another other similar finds in Northern Europe showing the same style of Buddha-esque art, but with what looks like a meditating Norseman. But I saw two versions. There was one that was clearly Asian and one that was clearly white. So it's very interesting.
It is very interesting. And you brought up the issue of the swastika, which is something that I didn't really discuss in my work. But I do believe it's very fascinating. I live in Phoenix, Arizona, in the United States. And I'm fascinated by the native peoples here. And you see the basketry of the so-called Tohono O'odham, or the Papago people and the Pima tribes and the various other Hopi, Anasazi, etc. And Mr. Nugent had talked about the Anasazi, and he doesn't believe that they are an indigenous people, but they are in fact an Indo-European people, which is a very interesting hypothesis. But anyhow, many of the baskets of these North American so-called indigenous peoples, the Amerindian people, have the swastika design. There is a tribe in the San Blas region of Panama which has a swastika flag. There are Chinese gables on temples that have swastika designs. I just went to, actually a few years ago, I visited Chinese gardens in Phoenix, and on the pagodas, they have gables with swastikas. Mm-hmm. So Iran has some swastikas on their mosques. You have swastikas in Nigeria. Some of the tribes, yes, some of the major tribes, I can't remember if they're Yoruba or Igbo, but on the so-called slave coast, they use a swastika as well. So here you're talking about a symbol used by different races.
India also, and all over the place.
India, of course, yes. And how did this symbol get known? How was it known throughout the different continents? Moreover, all of these people, or rather the majority of them, the Chinese, the ancient Teutons, the Meso and South Americans, the Iranians, know about a creature called the dragon. All of them have myths about a dragon. In the Iranian epic called Shahnameh, the Letter of Kings, there is a hero called Rostam. He is the Persian Hercules, and he fights some creature called a Kerm. Kerm has a great similarity with the German word for dragon, Wurm, das Wurm or der Wurm. And there is a town in Iran, very important historically, called Kerman, which apparently is where Rostam defeated the big worm or the big dragon. So again, how do all these disparate races through different times, not all of them were coeval with one another, how could they come to believe in a symbol like the swastika and a creature like a dragon?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So what this tells me, in my opinion, perhaps I'm a partisan, perhaps not, but I think that given my research and given what I have read by greater minds, such as Thor Heyerdahl and company, I think that there was a seafaring, or there were seafaring people of a Nordic strain, excuse me, who were able to go throughout the world, colonize, bring civility, culture and civilization, and spread the knowledge of their cultural motifs and their cultural and societal idiosyncrasies, such as the dragon, such as the swastika, etc. And I think it's very interesting that just to further this hypothesis, as you read in the book, that the Central Americans and the Mayans, for example, would put on fake red goatees on their faces and put on fake aquiline noses to symbolize that they were nobles. Now, that is fascinating. Mm-hmm. That is fascinating, because the Amerindians do not have facial hair. It's very sparse, like their ancestors, the Chinese and the other Siberian Mongoloids. However, who's hairy? It's not the blacks, because blacks don't have red beards. Now, speaking of red beards, the Somalis, the Muslims of Djibouti and Eritrea, the Muslims of Yemen and Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, in the Sunni Muslim lands, they tend to, with henna, dye their beards and their head hair red. What is that except a historical remnant, just like the Mayans, of a previous red-bearded or red-haired ancestorship?
Makes me think of the red-haired giants here in America,
yes.
Even.
Exactly, in the state of Nevada, exactly. So these red-bearded people, which again, the red-bearded blue-eyed barbarian went from southern India to China, and the red-bearded giants of the in Nevada, and also the other red-bearded folk that you find in Rajasthan and Gujarat and Kashmir and in around Nepal and in Iran, actually you have more red-bearded people than you do blondes. even though they're still a minority, you find these traits. You find these, I guess for lack of a better term, Celtic physiognomies, but Nordic nonetheless. You find these Nordic Indo-European peoples throughout. And the fact that these semi-Negroes of the east coast of Africa dye their hair red and their beards red. There's nothing in Islam about dyeing your beard red, but they do because it's cultural baggage, because their ancestors or their at least their overlords had these physiognomies. They, even one of the works of Thor Heyerdahl, I believe it's Fatu Hiva, I'm not quite sure. He talks about the Maldives and how the Maldivians, who are a Dravidian Muslim people, believe that the monoliths strewn across their so many islands were built by blue-eyed, red-bearded sailors and culture creators. So again, the myth is there. The myth is also on Easter Island, where the ruling class has elongated ears. That's why you find the Buddhists with elongated ears. The Incan nobility had elongated ears, kind of like these, this new popular gauging of the earlobes that you find in the punk scene in America and Europe. They would do that to their ears, and that was a sign of enlightenment and nobility. And the lighter complexion people, according to Heyerdahl's findings, were the ones with the elongated ears. They were lighter, they were more European, you had fair features, and the darker ones with the flatter noses, the shorter appearances, etc., lack those elongated ears. So I think that all of this ultimately comes together, and it shows that the Nordics were present or at the least touched terra firma in all these different continents and left their indelible marks of a higher culture and civilization throughout these various races and peoples throughout different times.
I like how you say we must approach these matters from a scientific and historical perspective and not political, because science and history today that doesn't fit the politically correct narrative is deemed racist nowadays. So if I were to come out and talk about this, people could say, but you're a white supremacist if you think that, right?
Yes, they will. They, of course, will. But, of course, given my last name of Ali Abadi and my appearance is a little more difficult.
So you can get away with it, yeah.
I can get away with it. And what I'll do is I'll shave the 5 or 6 copper red hairs I have in my beard and say, hey, I don't have anything here going. But no, you know, like many other countries, this is very interesting because there is a great deal of disingenuousness and hypocrisy involved in people who say racism and white supremacy. Because, and Iranians are guilty of this too, because they vote Democrat, but their hearts beat Ku Klux Klan. Many of them voted for Obama, but they don't want a black neighbor. So this is the hypocrisy in many of these immigrants. Now, in Iran, to this day, just like throughout Central Asia, throughout Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, India, all of these regions that have ancient Nordic blood. And when I say Indo-European, I really mean Nordic blood, fair complexion people. You find a great deal of pride that one's child is born with a fairer complexion. It's a sign of nobility for the Far Eastern Asians to have fair skin, as opposed to being a dark Cantonese Chinaman. Being a light Mandarin from northeastern China is considered a sign of nobility and a higher calling. And in Iran, green eyes are constantly raved about. Blue eyes, most definitely. I remember my mom telling someone, a friend, that, it's been a pleasure meeting you. Thank you. You have the most beautiful blue eyes. It was absolutely extraneous to the salutations and to the goodbye, etc. But she said, you have the most beautiful blue eyes. And he had beautiful, steely blue eyes. He did. And it's very interesting that even though they take on a politically correct, if you will, Pavlovian reflex and belief when discussing issues of race and the findings that we're discussing tonight, when you come down to it, they are proud of their Indo-European Aryan heritage. And they make claims very vociferously that my uncle had blue eyes, my other uncle had green eyes, she had red hair, she was born a blonde. And these things are very important in that region of the world. And they are highly sought after, just like in the black societies. If you are a light black woman, every black man is running after you. There's something very unique about you. And of course, we know, call it racism, call it whatnot, it is the truth that those who have more European infusion, more likely than not, are in areas of control. Not because of any artificial issue of privilege, which is really non-existent, but because of astute, innate intelligence, native astuteness, and native diligence. They are the ones that come out on top. And that's what I think.
And now today you hear the term blue-eyed devil instead.
Well, yes. Actually, in the ancient works, in some of the Far Eastern annals, they called Bodhidharma the blue-eyed devil, but it was not a disparaging term. They called him a devil because anybody who came from outside Zhongguo, outside the central kingdom, was a barbarian. So just like the Greeks, they thought anybody outside the polis was a barbarian. The Macedonians were bumpkins. The Persians, they might have been civilized, but they're not like us. They're still barbarians. The Egyptians, same thing. But what's interesting too, and I remember reading about this someplace, that if you remember, there's if you recall, the very famous Japanese director of the Seven Samurai, Akira Kurosawa, I believe was the gentleman's name. And in that great movie, the Japanese movie called The Seven Samurai, you see some depictions, and I highly recommend watching that concerning a discussion that we're having today. You see some of the Japanese, there's a Japanese nobleman, a very young man, and you look at his face, he does not look Japanese. I swear to God, he looks like very, very much a European, very fair complexioned, a kind of aquiline nose, very delicate bone structure. He is not your flat-faced coolie from Canton or Guangdong province, China. He is very refined, very European-looking, very delicate and fragile and gracile. Now, many of these samurais, when they would go into battle and you would look at the samurai costume, you look at the helmet, they have horns on their helmets. They look like the crescent moon, but some of them literally have horns, just like the cartoon character Hellboy, and also some sort of, if you will, Norse or Viking warrior. So the belief is that these Japanese... when they were probably being invaded by Viking-like peoples, they took on the ferocious mien or the ferocious style of attire of the Viking or their progenitors, etc., or their descendants. They took the Viking-like outfits and used it for their own, because there's nowhere... You know, you look at the Japanese and you look at the Viking costumes with the horns on their helmets, and you say, "Where did the Japanese get that?"
What year would this be taking place?
This, I believe, is in probably the Middle Ages of European civilization. So I think 1000, 1100, 1200, maybe a little later in Japanese society. I'm not an expert on the time on this subject, I just found this very interesting. I just found it very interesting and perhaps more than just coincidental. And here's something else. If you look at the guardian spirits of the Chinese temples and these Tibetan murals or artwork where they show these evil spirits or aggressive spirits defending a temple, they usually have bug eyes. Their eyes are bugging out, and they have elongated noses, and they have very un-Chinese, un-Oriental physiognomies. It could be that the Central Asian hordes, who were Indo-European, like the Xiongnu, the White Huns, that they built the Great Wall to guard against, were encroaching upon the territory, and Chinese nightmares and historical fears are grounded upon these big-eyed, scary devils, blue-eyed devils, so that their guardian spirits used to scare evildoers from entering the premises have these European eyes and these European noses. There's even Japanese Loki-like character, a little impish character. I believe his name is Tegu, T-A-E-G-U. I'm not quite sure. Memory doesn't serve me properly here, but he has a very long Pinocchio-like nose, which is a very un-Japanese trait. And the Japanese, as you know, with the Ainus, they are a people. They are actually the one of the top growers of facial hair in the Oriental world, in the Far Eastern world. And I have seen many Japanese men that can grow full beards, full mustaches. The Koreans less so, the Chinese much less so. But the Japanese are something else. And it's not for nothing that they are the most advanced Far Easterners of all the advanced Asiatics, a very noble people. And I think that's due to ancient Indo-European admixture.
Wow. Have you looked into the similarities in some of the ideas of Zen Buddhism with Norse mythology, what we know of it anyway?
No, unfortunately, I have not. But I have noticed, and there's a reference to one of the Zen paintings in the work, that the Bodhidharma is said to, or one of the Zen Buddhist statements is said to have stated, in order to find Buddha, look into yourself. And that's like what Jesus said in Matthew, the kingdom of heaven is within you. So I am not by any stretch of the imagination an expert or even in any shape or form knowledgeable about Norse mythology. But that is a religion that actually would really have, I think, should welcome an expert to answer this question that you just raised. I unfortunately don't know anything about that. But I would imagine that, of course, the concepts of nobility, of sacrifice, of perseverance in the warrior classes would be similar.
Thank you. And, I appreciate that.
Well, thank you for bringing that question up. Hopefully some intrepid soul will look into that.
Yeah, I'm also looking for someone to discuss the similarities between the Hindu Vedas and the Norse Eddas. I know that there's a lot of parallels there, so that's another area to go into.
Yes, there is. There is apparently on one of these websites, I believe Countercurrents, there was a recent, maybe about a week ago, a recent entry on, there's a, the guy's name, not Dumazil, starts with a D, but he wrote something, a treatise on Hinduism, and he compared it to ancient Norse mythology. So Indra, the god of thunder and lightning in Hinduism.
Oh, like Thor.
Yes, he had a red beard. He was a Nordic god. And very, very interesting again. Wow. Yes, but unfortunately, I'm very ignorant about that subject.
No worries. Well, some debate whether Bodhidharma even existed, but why would the Orient venerate a white man, right?
Yes. The hypothesis is that, of course, I'm always open to doubt. There could be many people make a case that Jesus Christ never existed. But, of course, the stories about Christ and the theology and the religion built upon him, I think, kind of go against that thesis. But ultimately, I think the reason why many people don't push for, or some people push for, the non-existence of Christ is really a culture of critique phenomenon. It's probably not hard research. But anyhow, Bodhidharma, if he existed or if he did not exist, the fact still remains that here is a Nordic white guy. You don't get as much Nordic, as any more Nordic than red beard and blue eyes, you know, came out of Ireland someplace, who is teaching Kung Fu, who is teaching meditation Buddhism, which itself is of Nordic origin. Buddhism is of Nordic origin, not of Chinese origin. And he is venerated, and he is considered a very holy saint, if you will, and founder of a major serious branch of Buddhism. Even in places far off as Vietnam, you have a very famous Vietnamese priest who's a Zen priest. His name is Thich Nhat Hanh. And Tit, T-I-C-H, in the Vietnamese language, is derived from Bodhidharma and from the Sanskrit terminology. And so they trace their heritage to Bodhidharma as the founder of Zen Buddhism. So here you go to this strange land of Vietnam, which is a cross between the great Chinese culture civilization and the Indian culture civilization. And the founder of this Buddhism, the introducer thereof, was a half a Sogdian, and his father was a full-blooded Sogdian who came over not through the Silk Route, but through the waterways to preach the new religion. So Nordics specifically have had a profound influence on the Far East, and many of these lesser-known Buddhist proselytizers on the Silk Road that translated Pali and Sanskrit sutras into the Chinese language. For example, Aryajuna, Nagarjuna, Buddha Bahadra, Buddha Sadra, etc. They are referred to as red-mustached or red-bearded barbarians. So this, again, is something that Chinese national nowadays would not be happy to acquiesce to because, yes, naturally, because we live in a century where white is bad and anything non-white is good.
Yep.
So whites cannot have this. But there are, believe me, there are millions of people in this world. Even in darkest Africa, you go to the Congo, and if they see a white man, they will go ahead and talk to and say, we miss you guys in the Belgian Congo. When you were here, cannibalism was under control. We had highways. We had railroad. We had train depots. We had medicine. We had jobs. When are you coming back? In Iran, they say, well, oh, the Republican Party is trying to put down us Persians because we're olive-skinned and not lily white-skinned, etc. But at the same time, they turn around and they say, yes, 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 my grandson, he has blue eyes. So, and this, again, is hypocrisy of the highest magnitude.
It's true. I mean, I'm well-traveled. I've been Africa, South America, a lot of remote places, and people were always kind to me and smiley to me, not like what's happening now when you're white and you're being greeted in certain non-white areas.
Yes, yes. America really is a construct of Hollywood and Madison Avenue. It does not represent the world. But unfortunately, the poison has seeped in globally as well. An example of this is in Iran itself. Iran is an Islamic theocracy, a Shia theocratic system. Yet, they have usurped, they have taken over the Marxist mantra of whites oppressing blacks so that they would have stamps commemorating Malcolm X back in the 80s when I collected stamps. They had an Iranian stamp of Malcolm X praying towards Mecca. And they're saying the same line of the great devil, meaning America, the great Satan or the great arrogance, is oppressing black people. So you go to Press TV right now on the web, an Iranian-run news agency, and just like the Russians from the Soviet times and RT.com, they are still saying, talking about police brutality and how oppressed blacks are in America. This is just leftover dross from the communist propaganda machine, which surprisingly the Shia clerics and the Iranian theocracy has taken on to itself. It's part of their political outlook. At the same time, you look at the Shia clergy, either it's Grand Ayatollah Sistani in Iraq, you look at Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, his nephew has blue eyes, Khamenei himself has a very rubicund expression, you look at the Shia clerics throughout Iraq and throughout Iran, majority of them are actually quite fair complexion, and the grandsons of the late Ayatollah Khomeini have blonde hair and green eyes. So these gentlemen are not representative of the majority of Iranians, that's true, but they show again that, if you will, if I can use it this way, blood is thicker than water, that the best rises to the top. And it's not because of white privilege. There is no white privilege in Iran, believe me. But it's because of essential innate intelligence and native ability that these people are able to quote-unquote lord it over others. It's just the natural order of things. That's the way it is.
Well, I loved your introduction in the book, and I felt like you were saying much more between the lines. And you wrote about how in the past, conquerors destroyed the cultures of their defeated. But today, the conquerors use social psychology in the technique they use to tell the particular nation that they have nothing to be proud of. Can you speak more about this idea that you wrote about in your introduction?
Gladly, yes. Essentially, that is being very, how do we say, being very, walking, very, treading very softly, not to upset the apple cart, because I too must live. And essentially, yes, what we have nowadays is an inverted world where the truth of the matter on racial terms and racial creativity and achievement and previous accomplishments have been dimmed, have been darkened, upon very much intended, to represent the inversion of reality, so that you have such absolutely asinine, farcical claims that the original inhabitants of the Indian subcontinent, the Dravidians, were the real Aryans. I have seen Indians, and when I tell them I'm Iranian, they say, oh, we're brothers. And he's very, very swarthy and flat-nosed and all. He says, we're Aryans. And I just, you know, nod my head. I said, yes, 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 yes. I don't want to be rude. I don't believe in hurting people's feelings. I'm not a mean guy. But honestly, in my heart, no, actually, the Nordics were the Aryans that came over. And you have, again, the belief in Iran that, well, we're Aryans too. And a Iranian researcher in the UK did work on, he's a geneticist, and he found that the overwhelming majority of Iranians don't have Indo-European genes. That means they are very denatured as far as their contact with Europe. Now, of course, Iranian is by far closer to a Dane than a Dravidian is to a Dane. However, the distance is still there through centuries of miscegenation. And even though the remnants are still there, you can still see it in bits and pieces, sometimes in whole parts, but still, overwhelmingly, it's denatured quite a bit. Now, Iranians say that, and of course, the farcical, probably the most laughable claim, and I'm being very serious here, is the claim of the Afrocentrists, who, when I just hear their stuff, I just walk away. I really have no patience for such monkey shines, excuse the pun. but anyway, the belief that they are Nubians, the belief that they built Egypt when in fact they were slaves, and there's a stela by Sesostros III, I believe, in the 19th in the 1900s BC, that says that no black, no Nubian shall pass here unless he is a slave. And so, of course, it goes against what they say. All of these claims are nonsensical. Now, away from the ludicrous notion of the African having built a civilization, because even the great Zimbabwean ruins of modern-day Zimbabwe, even though the soapstone falcon is the symbol of the Zimbabwean currency, or lack thereof, after what Mugabe did, that symbol they claim as a symbol of the Matabele people. But it's not Mugabe's people that did that created these. It's some sort of Phoenician, probably Semitic, mercantile people, or perhaps an Indo-European people, etc. Essentially a white people that built even that and mined the gold out of Matabele land in the modern-day Zimbabwe. It's nothing Negroidal about it. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And sub-Saharan Africa is well known for its lack of civilization. No written language, no nothing. So if they do not make these absolutely absurd claims of Afrocentrism, the bottom line is they try to reduce and obfuscate and deny Indo-European or so-called white historical achievements. Mm. And these are pre-historical achievements. You can still see and read the papers and read between the line the news articles of Ramesses the Pharaoh having blonde hair. And yes, he had blonde hair. He was a dirty blonde of some sort. So this kind of real history or revisionist, actually we're trying to revise it to fit in with the truth, has been denied to people of European heritage in North America because of Hollywood. And I have seen many Soviet movies, and some of them actually, if they don't have a very strong communist theme, they have a Russian theme, especially after what they call the Great Patriotic War. They're very touching, clean movies. I have seen National Socialist movies. I have seen movies from different regimes. I've seen some North Korean movies even, but no one is as adept and as, if you will, successful in manipulating through wonderful productions of movies as Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Hollywood has done more to change and destroy a successful breed of people than any other phenomenon in the history of the world. By movies, you manipulate people's worldview. And their worldview, since the purveyors of Hollywood have decided to sick it on the Nordic peoples of America, the true Native Americans, blonde-haired, blue-eyed people, the Nordics now are in absolute disarray. Now, of course, I think in many ways, Western civilization was in senescence, and it was it had major problems even before Hollywood, etc. But Hollywood accelerated this diabolically at a horribly quickened pace. Moreover, Hollywood has been so diligent and successful in its manipulation that here you have a people that welcome their disenfranchisement, their minoritification at the hands of people that want to slit their throats and gang rape their daughters.
I know, it's amazing.
It is amazing, and it is sickening beyond reckoning. And I hope to God that the situation will change 180 degrees. My fingers are crossed. I'm no prophet. I don't know what's going to happen. I have kind of a dim view of things. But anyway, I do hope that there is some sort of resurgence and renaissance in European peoples. I have been to Europe twice before. Back in 98, I toured for about 5.5 weeks. And about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, I toured Central Europe. And to see the sights that I saw, to eat the food that I ate, to see the people that I saw, it really is a rare species, a rare, beautiful species of bird or of mammal, if you will, or butterfly that is going extinct, and no one dares raise a fuss about it. And I'm not saying I support this people because, hey, they put me on welfare, or hey, I can drive their Audi or their, if I could afford it, or their BMW. No, it's not for personal reasons. I think it should be able to exist for its own sake, because its existence is vouchsafed by the fact that it exists, and it must have the right to exist. And furthermore, it actually has done a lot more good than any other people out there, and everyone turns to their music, classical music. I have, and I think if I've ever heard the voice of God on this earth, it's through classical music. And for me, Western culture, Western painting, Western literature, the Western people are beautiful. Men of all races look to white women, Nordic women, as the epitome and acme of beauty and pulchritude, and that's true. Nordic men are desired by many non-white women throughout the globe. They want white babies, and again, that's for a specific reason. Nordic men are the most handsome out there, in my opinion, and in the opinion of many other people and many other, again, different races and disparate peoples. And it is a shame that this people, the European people, are essentially glorying in their own denigration and in their own suicide. And in my own little way, I try to raise awareness and write about it and bring something else to the forefront. Because if you remember from the book, I made the reference that Bushido and the samurai code, the way of the warrior, are derived from Bodhidharma, the blue-eyed, red-bearded barbarian. And Star Wars of George Lucas fame is derived from the samurai, which means, again, from Bodhidharma. So whether you're in some Chinese temple, some Japanese island, or a judo, or where you study martial arts, or even on a spaceship fighting Sith lords, you actually are tracing that myth all the way back to Bodhidharma. So this is part of Indo-European, Caucasian, white proto-history or ancient history. And even before that, with the writings of Thor Heyerdahl, you have a people that have created so much in this world who are in such an absolute state of degradation and spiritual self-loathing that I can only shake my head in disbelief. I am really at a loss of words as to how brainwashed European Americans have become and how self-despising and self-hating they have morphed into. It really is a sin and crime against life.
Ollie, thank you so much for saying all these words. It's very inspiring, and it means a lot to me that you're vocal about this and speaking up about this, and I can't tell you how much that means to me.
Thank you.
Ollie, please let people know where they can get your book. It's a must read.
Yes. My book, Ali Aliabadi, Aliabadi, sells for a grand total of $2.99. And I think I will make off about $1 or $1.50 of the book sales. So I'm living it up. And your money does go to help me purchase and expand my testament to Western culture through music. Essentially, I just spend it on some CDs. It's just pocket money. What I really want, because it's so cheap and it's available on Kindle through Amazon, just type in Zen or martial arts or blue or red. And my name, Ali, A-L-I, and you'll see it on Kindle, and you can purchase it there for $2.99. And again, I'm only making about $1 off it. It's very cheap, and I want it to be excessively inexpensive because I want people, and I don't care if you make illegal copies and you sell it to your buddies and you try to wake people up. I don't think this will wake people up in any shape or form, but I believe perhaps, God willing, it has some sort of domino effect that it might spur on some sort of interest in the reader. In a few years, in a few months, what have you, that reader might delve into another subject and he or his or her awakening will occur. Again, I hope you enjoyed it. I have a science background, so it's very meticulous in its references and citations. I use original sources at times and then translated sources because I don't speak nor read Korean, Japanese, nor Chinese of the archaic variety. But you'll find it pretty interesting, and you can always go ahead and get a hold of me through my email address as well.
Really, I encourage the listeners to buy a copy. It's only $3 and it's a download. It's a short, highly interesting read. I was disappointed that it was only 40 pages, but it will take you into other rabbit holes of suppressed history. And it's been really, it's been a different kind of awakening for me. So I really appreciate it. A big thank you, Ollie.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here. I appreciate your time.
We should also say thanks to Arthur Kemp, who originally helped in publishing and releasing Ollie's book on martial arts, Zen, and the blue-eyed, red-bearded barbarian. If you download a copy of Ollie's book, he presents DNA evidence of Caucasians who roamed Chinese Tarim Basin 1,000 years before East Asians. You can read about, and I know I'm pronouncing these wrong, Xing Jiang's mummies with red hair, the Ying Pem man, a 2,000-year-old Caucasoid mummy, along with the Caucasian woman called the Xiaho Beauty, and also the Lindsay population, to name a few. And I find it interesting that there are similarities between the Caucasians in Asia at this time to the Afana Sivo culture in Siberia, and some believe these Siberians made their way to China. We have so much to learn about our European history. If you're listening and you know of other interesting Caucasoid finds that have been omitted from the history books, please get in touch with me. Let me know so we can talk about it on Radio 314. If you like what we do and you want to help support our projects, please sign up for a Red Ice membership to access all our material. Visit redicemembers.com. And of course, Radio 314 is on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Stitcher, Google Plus, and on RSS. And if you haven't, be sure to check out my new video called St. George and the White Whore. Sound shocking? Well, it is. It's available on redicecreations.com. We'll talk again soon. Yeah.